Well, good evening. So we had this incredibly beautiful spring day, and we had, from what I gather through my group and the others, the whole world of inner weather that flows through. And I think that for many, that this basic understanding that anything and everything comes and goes, and our suffering or our happiness is totally related to how we're beholding, how we're holding, how we're relating to what's here. And one of the great equations that I think has been given in this Dharma generation is that pain times resistance equals suffering. Pain times resistance equals suffering. Our pleasure times resistance equals suffering. Our anything times resistance equals suffering. Another way to say it is that pain times zero resistance, you know, anything times zero is zero. No resistance is the same thing as saying an allowing presence, a loving presence. So tonight what I'd like to do, and I like to do this on the Saturday night of retreat, because I think this first day always shines a light so much on, it's like what has been kind of pushed under because we've been busy. Because we've been in our daily habitual trance, often can start presenting. How do we untangle the tangles? In other words, if we find ourselves in reactivity, what allows us to move from reactivity to that freedom, that presence? And I'll begin with a story I heard recently. A while back, an old tired-looking dog wandered into the yard. I could tell from his collar, though no tags, and well-fed belly, that the fact that he was clean and he had a home. He followed me into the house, down the hall, and fell asleep on the couch. My dogs didn't seem to mind, and he seemed like a good dog, and I was okay with him, so I let him nap. An hour later, he went to the door, and I let him out. The next day, he was back, resumed his position on the couch, and slept for an hour. This continued for several weeks. Curious, I pinned a note to his collar that I wrote, quote, "Every afternoon, your dog comes to my house for a nap. I don't mind, but I want to make sure it's okay with you," unquote. So the next day he arrived with a different note pinned to his collar. He lives in a home with three children. He's trying to catch up on his sleep. May I come with him tomorrow? So I thought that might be a good Saturday night story about kind of the quality of inviting and gentle and tender. You know, we have this idea with practice, and we all get it, that there's supposed to be a certain way of being, that if it's painful, we should really hang in. You know, it's like we have these ideas of that are can be somewhat rigid on what awakens us. And there really is an art that's very compassionate of just listening in and knowing when to take a nap, when to take a break, when to become more refined in our attention, when to sense more space, when to lean up against a tree and let the tree, or lie down on the earth and let the ground really absorb our sorrows. You know, it's not one of those paths where it's like, you know, there's like this recipe. It's a listening in. So I'd like to explore what we sometimes call unconditional presence. This really deep listening and this kind listening. And one way that this mindful presence is defined that I think is probably the most useful is as these two interdependent qualities. And we'll probably come back again and again to this through the retreat, that an unconditional presence has the quality of recognizing. There's a cognizing. There's a kind of a knowing quality to awareness. So that in any moment with the questions, it's what is happening, there's a sense of wakefulness, just noticing. And you can just for in this moment sense, if you pause, there's an innate wakefulness, a knowing of sound, a wakefulness that receives sensation, a recognizing. That's one quality. The other quality of awareness, and they're again interdependent, is openness, sometimes called emptiness, which is that there's space that it happens to that's unconfined. It's a field of wakefulness. You know, it's maybe the best way of describing what we are is a field of wakefulness. So we practice to develop this kind of attunement, this kind of recognizing and openness that really allows us to flourish, to be all that we are. And I like the word attunement. It's used a lot in understanding attachment theory in terms of in our upbringings, what it was that ended up causing wounding if we didn't have proper attunement. What that means is if we weren't seen, recognized, and if there wasn't that allowing space, which is inherently caring and loving. So what we do when we meditate, this is one of my ways of framing it, is we're kind of spiritually reparenting ourselves. We're learning to offer that attunement to our inner life. So we'll go back to that in a bit. Buddhadasa, Thai meditation teacher, was asked to describe the world. And his description was lost in thought. And if we wonder what stops us from being attuned, what stops us from inhabiting that wakefulness and that openness, we're often a dream a lot of the time. And our challenge is that there's this ongoing chain of reactivity that our dream keeps fueling. And Eric spoke a bit this morning, and this is kind of the basic, and it's the elegance, I really think, of the Buddhist teachings and also of Western psychology, which is that in any moment there's always pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality going on. There's an experiencing. And with that, we have a reflex when it's pleasant to grab, a reflex when it's unpleasant to resist. And we kind of sometimes space out with neutral. And so, but that's not all. The reflex actually takes the form of this lost in thought. So one of the great words in Pali is papancha, that it's this proliferation. And how it goes, you can see here, you might get a pain in the back. And so what happens? You know, what's the proliferation? Well, it's pretty quick that there's all of a sudden an obsessive story about how to deal with it. You know, what should I do about it? Should I leave? Should I do more stretching? Should I be taking some muscle relaxants? And then there's this fear about the pain that it's going to keep going. It's going to get worse. It's going to ruin our retreat. You know, can see that. And then there's this embarrassment about moving or about being preoccupied. So rather than simply burning, twisting, aching, pressure, whatever, we've incarnated a self that's kind of victimized and oppressed by pain, and a self that's trying to figure out how to deal with it, that's fixated on the future implications. It's completely natural, this papancha, and we get trapped. It's what many of us call the selfing trance. You know, a self gets incarnated, pleasant or unpleasant, and then it gets wrapped around with stories. And the basic theme in the stories, something's wrong. So much of our inquiry tonight is going to be, how do we recognize and wake up from this prison of something's wrong? So if we look a little closer at how the Buddha described this trance, because really, most of our practice, we're not doing something as much as we're becoming aware of the selfing. The power of this practice is that the awareness of the selfing itself dissolves the identification. And if we think there's a self that's trying to do something and accept the selfing, that's more selfing. It's not fair. It's not fair to say one should accept this, because the self can't accept. The self's very organization is resistance. But we'll explore how does acceptance happen, and it's really just noticing. So the way the Buddha described it is that we have a basic perception of separation, that all organisms incarnate, and there's some sense of a membrane, and what's in here is self, and that's subjective, and everything else, if there's a subjective sense of moi, everything else is an object, including moi's experiences. So there's self, and there's all these experiences and objects out there. And with any perception and story and felt sense of self, the primal mood is fear. The primal mood is something's not quite right, because there's not an innate sense of belonging. There's a sense that we could be harmed by the objects out there or not accepted by the objects out there. So this is the existential predicament. There's that perception. And then what happens through evolution, you can see it. And I've been talking about this some on Wednesday night, and I want to bring it in here. If you imagine our earliest mammal ancestors, like little rodent-like creatures scurrying around in the shadows of the last dinosaurs, and the ones that became absorbed in pleasant sensations of a good meal or basking on a warm rock or, you know, sweet-smelling flowers, crunch. You know, they miss the sound of the slither. You know what I mean? And they're the ones that actually, who had nervous and jumpy genes, were the ones that passed them on and survived, right? So in a way, the ones that were quick to notice potential threats and quick to remember painful experiences are the ones we inherited their genes. I'm saying it because we take it so personally. And like we're designed, we're to have a nervous system. You know, I think that's really something. I mean, what we call imperfect, what we call trapped and unenlightened, is the literally way these bodies and minds are designed to survive. And I like science when it can serve to help us be forgiving. That it's really not our fault. We are designed this way. That doesn't mean that's the end of the story, so to speak. We're also designed to recognize the selfing, and in the recognition, discover a wholeness and a freedom that is sacred and precious. But the beginning is not to take it personally, because we get absolutely trapped in the selfing if we blame the self for all its self stuff. That's not eloquently said. So in the human brain, what happens is not only is there this generic sense that something is wrong, okay, this existential something's wrong, but it's attributed to the self. The self owns stuff, you know. So the something wrong is moi, that I'm wrong. And we live with that, and of course it's very much passed on through our families and our cultures. It gets exacerbated, the sense of something's wrong with me, in a culture that's competitive, in a culture that doesn't have natural ways of belonging, where we're every part, anywhere we are, whether it's school or family or spiritual group, there are these standards of what it means to be a together successful person and to be acceptable. So we're all living with that. We're all living with, in some way, the message of how we should be. And it's very interesting to watch and sense how many moments you're trying to be who you think you should be, how many moments there's a gap and a sense of not meeting the standard, how many moments the way of being with others is to present the self that will possibly get approved of and loved, and what that means in terms of spontaneity and trusting who we are. Okay, so story. Woman walks by a pet store, and there's a parrot out front in a cage. And as she walks by, the parrot goes, "Awk, you're stupid and you're ugly." And she thinks, "Well, that's strange. Oh, well, he must have just heard that somewhere and repeated it." But the next day she walks by the same parrot, and the same thing happens. "Awk, you're stupid and you're ugly." So she's annoyed and she wants to go in and tell the owner, but she's too busy. She has to get to work. So the following day, the same thing happens. The parrot goes, "Awk, you're stupid and you're ugly," and she is pissed. And she goes inside. She tells the owner, who's abjectly apologetic. He's really embarrassed. He says he's going to do some training with that parrot. Next day, she walks by. "Awk, you know." So it's silly, but the truth is that we don't need to keep being told anything negative. It's very deeply internalized in some way that we don't matter, or that we don't have what it takes, or that others aren't going to love us, or that whatever the storyline is. So when you reflect on what it is a child most needs, you know, if you say, well, a young being, what does it most need? As I mentioned earlier, it needs these two wings of to be seen for who we are, to really be seen, and to be loved. And it's not enough to have one. You can't just be seen but then not accepted. And you can't be loved and trust that unless somebody really gets who's here. This is the attunement. And how our parents are attuned to us, we tend to take on some of the same degree of attunement towards ourselves. If we weren't listened to, or if we weren't seen, if we were criticized, whatever, if they had a fear that we weren't okay, we adopt that fear. There's a cartoon I really like, because it kind of says it. It's with these two mothers that are having tea, and one of them has a son who's on this stepladder, and he has goggles and a blowtorch, and he's blowtorching into the wall the words, "I need love." And the mother says to her friend, "Oh, he's just doing that to get attention." So there's been a lot of research done on what happens when there's not attunement. I shared this on Wednesday, and I want to bring it in here because I think it's really powerful. They know, they've done for years, they've known with, you know, if you take a monkey and as a baby, and you take the monkey mom and baby apart, and so the child gets no touch and no attention, the child dies, you know, the baby dies. So they know that lack of touch, of isolation, will a creature can't make it. But more recently, they started doing experiments with primates on degrees of attunement. And they had some ingenious designs where in one of them they had the mother monkey who got a chimp, actually, was deprived of food in an unpredictable way. So she had a certain amount of anxiety about whether or not there would be food available and was preoccupied. So she didn't totally neglect her baby, but there was some neglect. And the result of having a chimp having a kind of partially preoccupied, neglectful mother was a high degree of anxiety, a high degree of depression, and binge eating. The serotonin levels shifted irreversibly for the rest of that chimp's life. It's just interesting that we think things are our fault, and our culture, our family, and our existential conditioning creates what Eric was describing this morning as this reaction and this attitude towards what's happening. It's really rigged. It's really designed in our system. And one of the metaphors I love the best from the Pali Canon is when the Buddha teaches of two arrows. And the first arrow is the experience that arises, you know, let's say fear or pain or sadness or whatever. The second arrow is that something's wrong with me. I shouldn't be feeling this. I caused this. It's my fault. The eyeing and mying arrow that takes it personally. If we have an experience here as we're on retreat of grief, our fear, our numbness, but if we then add a second arrow of this shouldn't be happening, it's my fault, it has bad implications about who I am, if we add that second arrow, then rather than living that life that's coming up, processing it, being with it, discovering freedom with it, what happens is we deepen our sense of identity as a separate deficient self. Carl Jung said that the strongest influence on the environment, of course on ourselves and on our children, is the unlived life of the parent. What that means is that in any moment that we're at war with our experience, that experience becomes unlived life. At any moment that we're resisting, and the main way, I just want to say it again, that we resist is we own it and say, something's wrong with me, this shouldn't be happening. We resist it by thinking we have to get rid of it, fix it. So for most of us, we have our own particular set of strategies for how, when something's difficult, how we respond. And for some, our bodies immediately numb out and block it out. And for others, we very aggressively start blaming ourselves or somebody else. And others get depressed. We sink down. You know, we each have our own strategy. And so this is where the trance locks in, because then we become identified with the strategy. I'm the depressed self, the oppressed self, the self that's trying to fix things. So one understanding of the spiritual path is that we're awakening from this selfing trance, and that we're awakening by recognizing it's happening, and in that recognizing, discovering our wholeness, discovering the innate freedom that's here when identity's not hitched to something smaller. Retreat is a really powerful kind of atmosphere for that, because there is a power to this kind of shared intention to pay attention. And when we start pausing, there's something really interesting that the things we've been running from begin to present. And it's like we start to get that awareness really wants to realize itself. In other words, our nature is to include the unlived life. Our nature is to become whole. And so all the parts of ourselves we have been not living, it's like one teacher describes it, it's Ajahshanti, he describes it as a jar with all this life in it. And as soon as you unscrew the lid and take it off, it's like all that bottled up stuff starts racing towards the light. And what's the light? Light is us. It's what we are. So this unlived life just starts racing towards our awareness. And then the challenge is, one of the reactions is, it's too much. It's going to be too much. I can't handle it. And some of you I know have experienced that. And then another reaction is, something's wrong with me for how bad this is or how much is happening. We have our different reactions. So the invitation here is, in a creative and gentle way, to discover the presence that can recognize and allow what starts kind of pouring out from this jar, what wants to be lived. And I like thinking of that. It helps me to think of it that way in myself, that when I start quieting down, that what wants to be included, what needs to be included for there to be a sense of being whole, is presenting. And then the acronym that many of you are familiar with, on what for me has been the most useful practice of presence, is RAIN. There's a Shakespeare on RAIN. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. That there's this gentle presence. And sometimes in the gentleness, there's this absolute kind of courageous here-ness. And at other times in the gentleness, we just create space. At other times we pray. There's different ways, but there's this gentle presence. So let's deepen our understanding of RAIN, and those of you that haven't heard the acronym, I'll go through it, and explore how what it really can mean for us here at retreat, for those of you in the weekend to really drop into it more deeply, in the week to really explore it over the time. The letters R-A-I-N, I'll just review them. R is recognize, and A is allow. So the beginning of RAIN are the fundamental qualities of awareness itself, to recognize and allow. Now, with allow, with both of them, there's a shadow. I want to mention that often when we recognize, it's a glancing blow. We'll go, oh, fear, fear, and jump away. So recognize has an embodied quality of recognition, feeling it in our bodies. Allow, the thing with allow that's challenging is that we often allow with the sense of bargaining mind. Okay, I'll be with this if it'll go away. And the problem is, of course, it knows, you know. So with recognize and allow, then, it deepens with the I. Because in order for recognition to be embodied and the allowing to be an authentic space, we need to stay and get intimate. And intimacy includes investigating. I think of the I as a double I. Investigate, get intimate. When we start investigating, we start noticing what our attitude is. Oh, I'm taking this very personally. Oh, I think something's wrong. If you can just catch that layer, there's a huge amount of dissolving of identification. And then the investigation goes, oh, so I'm believing, and we sense what we're believing, I'll never be happy again. And then the investigation goes, oh, and I'm feeling that grip in the chest. A heaviness, an ache. So we investigate. And with each bit of the investigation, the eyes also get intimate. We allow. We lean in. We make space for. We bring a gentle quality to it. The N is the freedom that's experienced. And it's a double N also. N is we're not so identified. If we've really become intimate, there's not so much identification. We're not identified, and in that not identified, there's a natural awareness, a natural wholeness that we re-inhabit. You can think of the N as the wisdom side of N is not identified, and the heart side of N is natural wholeness, natural loving wholeness. Story, just to illustrate this a little better. This was, I was teaching up at IMS a few years ago, a longer retreat, a 10-day retreat. And one of the women had come to retreat right as her relationship was falling apart. And she had had many failed relationships, but she had gotten married, had gone for 5 years, and now she was in a divorce. And she was depressed and anxious and felt shut down to anyone in her life. Her history was that her father had left her and her mom when she was very young. And she, the night he left, she stood there watching, and he stormed out of the house without looking at her, and he never said goodbye, and he died several years later. That's background, okay? So her belief was, I drove him away, I did something wrong, he left because of me, and I'm unlovable. And that's the fear and the belief that she brought into every subsequent relationship, that she was going to somehow rather drive somebody away. So we began to practice RAIN, and the beginning of recognize and allow is just to recognize that she was really, really depressed, really anxious, a kind of hopeless feeling. And to just add that just the allow was the simplicity of the way Ajahn Sumedho puts it, it's like this. Just this acknowledging of, okay, so here's how it is right now. So that's the beginning of it. It goes much deeper, but at the beginning we just to recognize what's happening on some level and go, okay, this is what's happening here. And then we began to investigate. And as you might imagine, the belief that was there was that she'd always be rejected and she'd always end up alone. And the feeling in her body was a kind of fist in the chest, this clenching. And when I asked her how long that had been there, she said basically all my life. She couldn't remember a time that there wasn't some anxious clench in the fist, like around the corner, something was going to be taken away, some big loss was going to happen. So that's what she was living with in her body. And when she recognized that how many life moments had been sacrificed to that tensed up thing of around the corner something's going to be taken from me, how she hadn't enjoyed life moments because she was always tensing against that, that's when she had the moment I kind of think of as ouch, this kind of a it's sometimes I call it a soul sadness, or she could see the shape of her incarnation and sense, and some of you might be able to sense this in your own lives, how the pattern of resisting has stopped really being able to let love in, has stopped you from really loving fully, has stopped you from really being able to enjoy beauty and rest in that, in the wonder of it, has really in some way stopped from being really who you can be. This resisting, this living in the story of what's going to go wrong. We all have the stories. For her, that moment of getting that clenched fist had been there all her life, and it stopped her from relaxing, had made it impossible to let love in, was when things kind of cracked open, and she really felt that ocean of tears. That's the shift moment, by the way. When instead of feeling something and adding the second arrow of I shouldn't be feeling this, or I deserve to feel this, or I'm always gonna, there's just the direct contact. Just recognizing and allowing just this, then the grief could be opened up, the unlived, the grief that really needed to be felt. Just this. And when I asked her, what does that grieving place most need from you? And that can be a very powerful question at certain moments. When you feel the stuck place and you're directly in contact and you just ask, what does this stuck place need from me? This is investigation. For her, it was very clear that it needed a tremendously loving presence. And I had told a story I sometimes tell about a Hawaiian healer who basically, his way with healing others and himself was to sense where the clutch of stuckness and pain was and to offer the message, I'm sorry, I love you. And the I'm sorry isn't an apology, it's I'm sorry I care about this and I love you. And so she put her hand on her heart and just started offering that message, I'm sorry, I love you. And for the next 5 days, and she was sitting up front so I could kind of see her pretty well, she had her, I said, any time it comes up, any time you feel the grief, just feel free to respond to what the grief needs. Well, she had her hands on her heart for 5 days straight, pretty much the whole time her hands were on her heart. And she was just basically offering, I think of this as, you know, a kind of ongoing shower of rain of self-compassion. I'm sorry, I love you. And at our next interview, she described what the Buddha talks about as a shift in identity, which was more than being the one who had been abandoned or was unlovable, she was that presence out of which that message, I'm sorry, I love you, was coming. Do you understand that shift? Going from the stuck place to the presence that's responding, that's caring. There's a verse I love by Dorothy Hunter. She writes, in this choiceless, never-ending flow of life, there's an infinite array of choices. One alone brings happiness, to love what is. As I mentioned earlier, we can't legislate a self to love what is, or to accept what is, or to do anything. Selves do, but it's all, you know, resistance and grasping. So how we go from stuckness to loving what is through a very courageous presence. The love is what we are. If we can undo the selfing trance, we actually live that love. We become that love. So for this woman, she had to see and investigate all the ways that her system was hitched around something's wrong with me, and bring this courageous presence to exactly what was there in her body. And in so doing, in a moment of not resisting, the self-compassion naturally arises because there's nothing obscuring it anymore. A moment of a story of something's wrong with me and it clamps down. I want to tell you about a couple more interviews so you get a sense of how rain deepens. So she had recognized and allowed and investigated, gotten intimate. The shift was natural awareness. She had tapped into a natural compassion. And so she started bringing rain to her father's experience. Because the truth is, if you can bring that investigation, intimacy to your inner life, you can bring it to others, including those that aren't here. And so the question was, well, what was happening in his body, in his heart, in his mind at that time when he left? And she knew. She said he was afraid. He felt trapped in a marriage that was dead, and he felt like he was losing his life. And what he needed to live was to escape from that marriage. It was his only hope. And then I said, okay, so now he's seeing his daughter standing there, and what's happening? And so here's what she said. I can't go to her. I love her too much, and I wouldn't be able to leave. I'd die then. I have to get out. So then she could weep deeply, not for her own, just for her own sorrows, but also for that incredible pain her father was in, and for all who feel divided, who all feel the loss of love. So this was the widening of the circles. And this is when we do compassion practice, we pay attention to the suffering here and open our hearts with that tenderness, and it naturally begins to tune in, to have an attunement that includes others. Final interview. She was still having this kind of now and then these stories of this, that it'll never be that I'm close with anyone, and feeling a sadness. And I asked her, is that true? You know, you believe you'll never be close. You know that's true. And there was enough stillness and space that she could say, no, I don't know. And in that not knowing, in that pause of, no, I don't know that's true for sure, there was a real kind of an opening, a dropping in. And then I could ask her, well, who would you be if you didn't believe that? If you didn't believe that you'd always be alone or you couldn't be close, who would you be? And as you might imagine, she didn't have an answer. She just had a kind of a sigh and a kind of a sense of just bodily freedom. This is the freedom of non-identification. That is, that when we don't believe our beliefs, the sense of the self that we're identified with dissolves. Srinivasa Sargadatta said it beautifully. He said, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. So that's the end of rain. And for this woman, it was both the end of that love of feeling that sense of everything, of belonging, of holding her, the currents of her own pain and her father's pain. The end of the heart, of natural, loving wholeness. And it was the end of not identified, no thing. There was no story. There was nowhere she felt she was landing as a separate self. This is a poem by Dana Fald. She says, why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the Beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy, I'm afraid, and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true nature, in the freedom of your being. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in the stories of deficiency and failure. This is the day of your awakening. So this practice of unconditional presence, of rain, as we recognize and allow and begin to investigate, what we mostly come upon, and I like to come back, circle back to this again and again, is that there's an often unconscious but really potent second arrow of something's wrong with me for this happening. This shouldn't be happening. We make ourselves wrong. And if you can see that, if you can see that, then there's some space, then there's some freedom. Each of us carry these ideas of how we're supposed to be. We do. I remember seeing these church bulletins I really liked, and one of them read, "Sermon this morning, Jesus walks on water. Sermon this afternoon, searching for Jesus." One of the things I've discovered with rain, because I've been working with it more and more, it's easy to think of rain as a tool of how you're going to get rid of bad feelings. It becomes a bargaining mind tool, so you to be careful of that. Oh, I'm feeling bad, I'll do rain on this and get rid of it. So I just want to alert you, because the more I do it, the more I see that we can take anything and reify it and entity-ify it and use it as a fixing tool. And yet, if you sense your aspiration to be free, your aspiration for truth, that really we practice to realize who we are, to live from who we are. And it's from that sincerity that then we begin to recognize and genuinely say, what's happening? And genuinely sense, can I be with this? Then the recognizing and the allowing can drop in very, very deeply. What I found is that it's never a one-shot with rain, especially when there's a tangle that's a real familiar tangle. You know, the ones that most of us find that we keep wondering why. Well, I was dealing with that when I was a teenager. I can't believe it's still happening. Those. It's not like a one-shot of rain. It's that we keep on showering that presence over and over and over again. And what happens is it stops being these steps that you have to think your way through. And it can become a very spontaneous noticing and allowing. And one of the areas I have that I've been really practicing with a lot is rain on blame. And rain on blame is a great one, I find, because blame, Ramana Maharshi said, comparing mind and blame, last thing to go. And it's also in the stages of insight. It's just we compare and judge. So for me, usually the context is the more I'm busy, the more I speed up, the more there's a consolidation with this identification as a busy self that's trying to get things done to soothe her nervous system and make herself feel better about herself, and that things that get in the way are objects to blame. And when I feel like I'm getting in my own way, I blame myself. And if I feel others are getting in my way, I blame outward. And so that's become a flag. You know, I talked about the flags of trance. The blame is a flag for me. And so I pause. And I'll notice the speediness and the uptightness and the blaming mind. And I'll recognize it and go, okay, it's like this right now. You know, irritation, blaming. And sometimes it's a little seductive. I'll do that and I'll go, okay. And then I'll just zip right back into working real hard to get more done and continuing my stories of blame. But if I'm lucky, if the gods are shining on me in some way, I'll keep pausing. And I want to just invite you to check that out, that to pause and then repause, or to let go and then let go again and let go again. Because it can go very deep. So for me, if I can pause again, what I'll find in my body is this clutch of anxiety, almost always underneath there, or some vulnerability. And if I can stay, it becomes a current in a larger space. It just becomes clear that it's not a self that's blaming. There's just this anxious energy that's clutching into blame. And then there's some compassion towards it. And if I keep investigating, even, I can really say, well, who's doing or who's blaming? And that can be really powerful. There's an inquiry I've been practicing a lot lately when I get stuck, really, which is, how is presence experiencing this? And you might right now, just for a moment, we'll just pause together. And just scan and sense whatever is going on right now. And if there's been a theme through the day that's been difficult, if there's been something that's come up that's been difficult, let that be included. And as you do so, just feel a sincerity of, just in these few minutes of practice together tonight with rain, that really this is in service of truth, of becoming more real, of becoming who you are. So if there's some difficulty that's been coming up, and if there's not, just whatever's right here, our practice in the most basic way are these two qualities of awareness, of just recognizing what it's like. And agreeing to let it be. For now, just to let it be. And we deepen this pause to be present by just investigating the what it's like. So if something's been difficult, you might sense the attitude that's been here in relating to it. That this is getting in the way of my retreat. That I did something wrong, that this is here. It's my fault that this anger or judgment or sleepiness or whatever pain has been here. Or maybe that I'm a victim of this. What's the attitude? What's the eyeing and mying attitude? What's the experience in the body of this difficulty? When you're caught in it, what's it like? How does presence experience this? does the empty heart experience this? Continuing in silence for a few moments, simply noticing whatever is predominant around this experience or right in these moments, and exploring what it's like to completely let be. No resistance. Whatever is arising right now, what happens when you notice and there's no resistance? Just yes. Be the presence that's listening, feeling, receiving this life. David White writes, in his poem, Sweet Darkness, when your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision is gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you can be sure you are not beyond love. The dark will be your womb tonight. The night will give you a horizon further than you can see. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. So as a way of closing, just to say that whether you're here for a weekend or a week, really the blessing of this practice is realizing this presence and this love that can hold this life. And there's an understanding that when we trust we're the ocean, when we really trust this vastness and mystery of what we are, we're not afraid of the waves. There is room for this grief and this hurt and this fear. And there's room for this beauty and mystery so that we really can celebrate these moments. We can live them fully. So just in these last few moments right here for this time, just to continue sitting in the stillness, Sri Nisargadatta, one of the great Indian non-dual teachers, says that upon realization, you can't exactly explain what happened. Sometimes all you can say is, nothing is wrong with me any longer. So what if there is no longer any belief in the story of something's wrong? Still the currents of excitement or fear, sadness or peace. Nothing wrong. Namaste.